Hey, we're here at Slush. It's Phil from Deconstructor Fun. I'm joined today by the CEO of Machinations, Mihai Geza. Hi.
Hi, Philip. Thank you so much for the invitation. It's an honor.
And Slush has been true to its name. It's been snowing and slushy outside.
It has, and it's been freezing. It's exactly as you would picture it.
How many VC vests have you seen so far at Slush? Is that a real thing?
Very real. And okay. It's not only VCs now, it's founders that wear Patagonia as well. I guess just to confuse each other.
Tell me about Machinations.
Machinations.
What does Machinations solve?
Complexity. Complexity, chaos. It solves the lack of understanding that we have for this inherent hyper-complex systems. And we think we handle that in a spreadsheet and we think it's science and it's not. Machinations, I think, does three fundamental things which distinguish it from everything else we've been doing. One is to visualize these systems on a map. Second, you see them unfolding to life, and that's by simulation. Third, it helps you balance them, and that's the cherry on the cake.
So let's say I'm an economy designer on Monopoly Go. How can Machinations help me become a better economy designer on Monopoly Go?
Right.
What could it tell me that Excel couldn't? Because almost every economy right. designer right now is going to whip up Google Sheets or Excel. They might have a little bit of VBA embedded somewhere in there. They've got some pretty charts. Why do I want to learn a new tool? What can it tell me? Because the payoff's got to be worth it for the pain.
Good point. And there's two questions in there. A versus spreadsheets, and B, Monopoly Go, like the use case. Versus spreadsheets, see, you slipped in there something very subtly, which is a bit of VBA. If you look on the across this entire industry and all the thousands of designers and developers that I've met or we've met over the past decade or so, a bit of VBA is very, very rare. It's like 0.1% or something. Arguably, you can go in the space and say, oh, there's a bit of Python. That's even rarer. Most of them have vanilla spreadsheets. And if you open up a vanilla spreadsheet 1,000 times, it's a static division in there instead of a probability. It looks exactly the same 1,000 times. You're looking at one idealistic, skewed vision of the future. You're looking at one player journey. Not to mention looking, the act of looking in 100 columns over 1,000 rows. Very, very difficult to actually put that in your mind and causality and work with them. And these formulas, at some point, you reach the character limit within a spreadsheet sheet. So again, visualization and the fact that it does, Machinations does Monte Carlo. So it does that little VBA thing that you mentioned with a click of a button, and it fires up Lambda servers and gives them back to you in due time. And I could go on and nerd out, but I think visualization and out-of-the-box Monte Carlo, that's for starters. That's to answer the first part of your question. Second part of the question, Monopoly Go. I've actually been playing it. I kind of felt you would bring it up. And I just saw this morning the title made a billion. Congrats.
Incredible. Yeah. Incredible. In yeah. Under a year.
Under a year. You have progression. You're building buildings. They reap something. You have a core loop. You have a meta loop. And you have the pacing and distribution of content over player agency. And that's a fancy term for randomness. You roll dice and it rolls and it keeps rolling and you can auto roll. That thing, like how much money am I going to get per roll? It feels a bit scripted in the first few levels. As soon as you go beyond that and you go across levels, what happens then? What happens for someone that plays 1 minute a day, 3 minutes a day, half an hour a day? What happens if I get boosts and power-ups? What if I get attack? If I have friends, if I don't have friends, if I put a shield on my building? All of those questions create emergence, and you get this chaotic, untamable potential field of possibilities. Machinations helps you look into that. And most, this would be the moment I would expect the question, but how accurate is it? And sure, you say that before launch is as accurate as your assumptions. But the point is, you find the levers. Monopoly Go is a good example. Any other farming sim building games, just as a good, virtually any game that's got any sort of metro progression in it. What happens is, at some point, the causality and the knobs, think of them like the tiny cogs in an engine, they get so overwhelmingly, there's just too many. A diagram on a mature title has, on average, 3,000 moving parts. Now imagine keeping in your mind 3,000 parts, and even in a spreadsheet, 3,000 parts, handling them. So you get into that question of, if I want to influence something at level 10, what is the best return versus cost? What's the tiniest thing I can change to create the maximum impact I want on player experience, retention, and obviously monetization in the case of Monopoly Go? And Machinations helps you find that, I dare say, with a few clicks of a button.
So when people are using Machinations, do you find that they're building all of the game logic in Machinations? When it comes to all of the switches we were talking about, I could, for example, in Monopoly Go, I could choose to have a multiplier of 20 for some of my rolls. I could choose to have a multiplier of 100. I could choose to build my little bases on my boards, or I could choose to just keep my cash where it is. I don't have to go to the next board, Monopoly Go.
Yep.
So to your point, there's so many choices that I can make in Monopoly Go.
Yep.
Is the assumption when I use machinations that I'm going to build in the logic of those choices, that I'm going to almost in some sense simulate the game engine and what the engineers have built into the game?
Very good question. In the last part, that's the distinction between the game engine, all the paths that the game can take, and player agency. We call them player personas, whatever you want to call them yourself. We've called them so many things since analytics. The way players interact with the system, think of it like a structure on the diagram on its own. Their prevalence to spend, hoard, take risks, less risk, all these things you model up to give you the frame, the paradigm. The most complex diagram we've ever had was actually that of a board game. In a simple board game, like four people at a table. And that's because when you start modeling player agency, all these game theories, what if I do that, you're going to do this, then the diagram gets very extensive. So to go back to the initial question, the level of depth that you can model is virtually unlimited. It's Turing complete, and you can go down to quantify whatever sort of behavior you want. But I think Monopoly Go in itself is a good example because you can pretty much model anything that goes on in there, for there isn't an actual physical gameplay, jumping, shooting, because machinations pretty much stops at jumping and shooting. Like, it's an abstract layer on top of that.
When you were a designer, did you come across a particular situation where you said, wow, I really wish I had a tool that helped me understand what was going to happen on D7?
Oh my God.
Like, I know it sounds like machinations, it's hard to just imagine machinations from, you know, tabula rasa, from a blank slate. Is there anything that you found when you were being a designer that's, wow, I really wish I had?
Yes. Yes, Philip. Okay, here goes. I was a junior game designer, maybe mid, whatever. There were far more experienced people next to me. And in my, I'm trying not to insult them. Nobody knows the names. Nobody cares. It's a decade ago, right? I'm a kid. There's someone far more experienced next to me. We're all looking, including a producer, a product owner. It's like a team. I own the spreadsheet. Four other people look in the same spreadsheet. We have a 50-50 chance of something falling out of a box. That something falling out of a box will dictate whether players move forward or not. One of those playbook mistakes, right? So I look at that shit. I look at that cell and I'm like, I think more than half of our players are going to flip and rage quit. And I think there's a chance this is going to be bad. Four other people look in the same cell. They look at 50%. They're like, ah, no, this is fun. We're shipping fun. Ship it. I mean, it's Friday, 4 p.m. or something. We're supposed to ship it. And I have a UA campaign to start, all configured and nice, to get, it was the soft launch. And I can't articulate why it should be less than 50%, or it shouldn't be that at all. I know it's in me. My entire being is screaming, damn, don't do this. Other people are like, no, their gut feeling tells them something different, and I can't prove it. I ship that. I throw away half of the user acquisition budget or more. The entire cohort is churned. We've wasted weeks and tens of thousands of dollars in effort and caused just the frustration of the golden cohort. And I knew it was wrong and I couldn't. So I flipped an effing table and I'm like, how do I solve this? What is going on? And I started searching for it. And it's like basic Google searches. And somehow revolving around the problem was game economy design tool. And I landed on this wiki with an embedded flash. And that's how I came across machinations. And I would describe that phenomenon, if I had the chance to describe it now, I'd call it hippo, like highest paid person's opinion. And me as the underdog, I had, you know, that revolutionary, that what is it called, rebellion. Oh, I'm going to prove you wrong. I'm going to be my own man, Dark. Go prove the entire industry wrong with their gut stealing opinions on numbers. There is no gut feeling on science. Math is ruthless. Now it sounded a bit dark.
Could you take me through a really basic simulation using Monte Carlo in machinations that a designer would find fruitful to pursue in the program? So let's run with the Subway Surfers example a little bit more. So one of the things you mentioned is it's an endless runner. So I log into the game and I start a session and my character is automatically moving and I'm swiping to the left, I'm swiping to the right, I'm trying to dodge objects. Mm-hmm. There's this design principle that the game gets harder the longer the run goes for. Can you talk a little bit about how Monte Carlo would be valuable in the Subway Surfer simulation versus using a traditional spreadsheet in which it's challenging to do to Monte Carlo?
Right. Okay. First of all, the difficulty slope in Subway flattens, which is why you get these 10-hour runs. over the part where the slope increases. Let's pick a point where the odds of you crashing are 25%. That's if I recall correctly, but I think most of these writers get to some sort of form of abstract. Like there's a 10% chance of failing in the first 30 seconds, then it's 30, then it's 60, then it's whatever, it just increases. If it's, let's say 50% for the sake of simplicity, you get to that point where every single second you're about to crash. 50% odds of you crashing in a spreadsheet, what does that mean? It means half of your players are going to be able to progress, right? Like, and what does that mean in Monte Carlo? Actually, what does that mean in statistics? It means instead of pass, no pass, pass, no pass, pass. That's your spreadsheet. That's 50%. It means pass, 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 fail, fail, pass, fail, pass, pass. It's the act of building statistics from the ground up by actually rolling the dice. Instead of doing a static division and say half of your players are going to progress, you look at every single player journey and all the means by which the randomness intricacies of what happens if I pick up a boost, what happens if I'm better, what all of these what ifs, when they combine, they result in something very different than these high level flip a coin statistics, because that's why people lose all their money in casinos. And that's how you get the black swan effects. And that's why how you get all of these mathematical aberrations, because when you plot a line in a spreadsheet, you plot these averages in a spreadsheet, it's a thin, smooth line of how this difficulty curve evolves. When you do it in machinations with Monte Carlo, you get a chart which has a base min line. Everybody's going to get to some, of course, some people may actually die every single step along the way. So I guess the baseline of the chart is you always die. Everybody always dies. And then you get a median, then you get a mode, and that's maybe 18% of them are going to be able to pass minute 10. And then 25% of them are actually going to be able to pass minute 8. And then there's a maximum slope where, you know what, a tiny fraction of your players are actually going to be able to play for 10 hours.
All right, so I've got the simulation set up for Subway Surfers or Monopoly Go. It makes some predictions about, let's say, what level a player will be by day X in the game. By day 7, I hope they're at level 30. Yeah. There's going to be distribution of players, of course, at each of those levels by day X based on a number of assumptions we put into machinations. The game comes out. I'm collecting live data. Is there any way I can feed live data into machinations to help improve my predictions or help improve my simulations?
Why, thank you, Philip. I did not make Philip Batten ask me this question. Yes, apparently it is as of about 6 months ago. As a subproduct, we call it Live Ops. It does data ingestion. You pull in JSONs, you can sync from a spreadsheet if you update that spreadsheet from a different extrusion, whatever sort of external telemetry data. We're not working on integration, game analytics and Unity analytics and so on. Data, reality coming from outside the field, outside the diagram, that turns these simulations into predictions. What do I mean by that? Before you launch something, before you deploy an update, you have assumptions over what your players are going to do. Think of the diagram nodes split into 3 categories. Things that players will do before you launch, that's assumptions. That's KPIs like MAUs, DAUs, chances of passing a level, bit difficult, skill. On the other hand, you have God parameters, like design parameters. So you have full control over them. Drop rates, difficulty, costs. And then the third category, in fact, you have things that you look towards. We'll just pick the two most simplistic ones, which is progression, as in retention, and monetization. And those are the 3 key categories. Now, in that first one, which is assumptions, prior to launch, post-launch, they become telemetry KPIs. If before launch, all of these parameters would provide simulations, and that is a far better guess than a human's guess, let's just say that. That's science on top of guesses. After launch, if you actually feed in the data for your assumptions, they become predictions. And you do this process over the course of a few weeks or maximum 3 months, which is called calibration, and you get a crystal ball. Ta-da!
I've been on the Machination website, and one of the things that I've found to be really interesting is that you've started to make a lot of the simulations that people build public. It's almost like a shared repository.
Mm-hmm.
What has been the most successful machination on the platform?
The one that went viral, it was a Web3 diagram for a Web3 game called Kaiju Kings. And the developers were asked by their community to prove and express the tokenomics from their yellow paper into a bit more than just literature.
No, really?
This is what
I actually had to prove something. I like the fiction stuff.
I'm paraphrasing. I guess you can go ask the developers themselves. But the point is, they did a bounty for the person who's going to do this to prove the math, to work with the math. And one of the community members, for a bit of ETH, came up with the machinations diagram. I think it's surpassed 10,000 views within a month or so, because all the community that had backed the game started looking at it and playing with it. And tokenomics is one of those things that, you know, you don't want to get wrong before you print the smart contract. Now we're seeing all sorts of things that bubble up to the top. Hunter, RPG Maker, idle game diagrams, all sorts of things.
I hesitate to use the word future and Web3 together, but one of the most successful machinations on the platform is for tokenomics.
Yeah.
Has Web3 adopted machinations?
More than Web2 or whatever. Web3, what are we talking about? The last figure I have is 2,000 games.
A handful.
Right? 2,000 games, 1,000 raises, like IGOs or coin offerings. All the buzz, ridiculous amount of buzz compared to this volume that we're facing. Within the small sphere, I would say we're very popular. I think more than one in two developers at least knows about machinations, if not has used, played, dabbled, adopted, became a customer, used it in live ops all the way. So different spectrum of the funnel. I think the reasoning behind that is that machinations is not only math and money, but with Web3, it's also data. It's public data. Maybe that's from our perspective, and maybe that's me being biased. But when I look at it, it's the logic of money. And by money, I mean not only virtual currency causing a free-to-play conversion and the LTV you mentioned, but these are assets. And public data is blockchain. That's a match made in heaven. That I think it fits beautifully.
So when I think about Web3, and especially Web3 economies, the defining feature of them, almost by definition, is tradability, that assets can be traded, which is something that was usually only restricted to MMOs. And when you have tradability, you're going to get floating prices. And that seems like a whole new world of complexity. Are game economy designers and modern development studios ready for that level of complexity that MMOs have been dealing with for decades? Successfully and unsuccessfully, I guess you might add.
And not only do they think they're ready, they're enthusiastically throwing it out there that they want to trade these assets not only on primary markets within their own game ecosystem, but outside of their games. Let's have these assets being traded and ported and transported from one title to the other in the whole Web3 metaverse. I'm going to take my sword, and from this fantasy RPG, I'm going to take it in that sci-fi spaceship racing. Are you, as everybody, what is going on? Can we please hold the dialogue? They're not ready. Nobody's ready. And nobody's ready, and I don't dare say nobody cares. I think they're unaware. I think one of the most relevant statistics I've seen in the Blockchain Gaming Alliance survey was that 70% of the teams developing Web3 titles have never developed a title prior to that in their life. 70. And that's, you know, both of our faces now go, whoa, wait a second. If you don't know what it takes to ship a title, how can you start adding a Web3 economy on top of that? You need to ship a title, ship a successful title, ship a sustainable economy, operate the real world economy successfully long term. The Venn diagram of that happening just shrinks. So I guess that's one way of explaining why this happened. Now, that's the derogatory negative side of looking at it. The other way of looking at it is that in the same generational paradigm, nobody cares. And these are just concerns in our head, like you and I, Philip, and all the people that have witnessed the grunt of what happened in game economies for the past decade or so. They don't care. And maybe there's something healthy in that when it comes to taking these huge risks and experimentation. For the question, no, the reason why I believe in Web3, whatever it's going to be called, whether it's Web3, whether it's NFTs, or it's crypto, it's blockchain, it's metaverse, it's real world economies, whatever the manifestation of all this phenomena is going to be in this next iteration, I believe in it. I fundamentally believe in it long term, because remember that equation of labor being turned into money, labor being turned into assets, which cost money. This money economy has been going on for at least a decade now. And you just mentioned MMORPGs, right? And we've all know the gold farming and the skins and the $600 knife and the whatever hundreds, thousands of dollars horses can. They're there. So maybe there was just too much blockchain in the mix without the proper use. Maybe it was just enthusiastically thrown technologies at it. But something is happening to the point of games eating the world. In my view, there has to be some sort of instantiation of the future we've all seen in the Black Mirror episode, with the dude running on a treadmill getting points which feed him. There's got to be some of that in the future. I think the collective unconscious of all of us, just as we agree that there is a huge possibility for a post-apocalyptic world and sky beams and all of these manifestations in pop culture, there's got to be some Ready Player One universe where what we're going to do in these games affects the real world economy. Whether that's for blockchain, for assets, for NFTs, I do not know. And the speed at which this is a comment made by Edward Castronova, aka Ted, who we've been working with for about 2 years now on articulating the what we call the fundamental pillars of a sustainable health and healthy economy.
The original game economist in many ways.
A definite ghost. And he said that what's fascinating to him is the speed of iteration of these Web3 economies going from scratch with development teams that know mostly nothing about anything. Now I'm being insulting to a lot of developers, but maybe I am. I don't know. Let's skip that. Maybe I'm just okay. So a bunch of people trying to achieve something without any prior knowledge of it and getting it to a level. It takes a lot less people to create a functioning economy in Web3 than it is in free-to-play. And this is, again, in the words of Ted, within 1,000 to 2,000 people, you get that villagey type of economy, which works. You don't need that large scale. And again, somehow they've managed to make it happen, regardless with all the issues and the inflations and the crashes and burns, excluding all the fundamental issues of Web3, but just these experimental economies in Web3, which have gotten to the next level, go to prove that this has legs, that this will evolve. And it's evolving at an unparalleled speed. Like we've written within 2 years or so, the core economic practices that we've developed as, I don't know, in the days of seashells trading on a beach. Is that an answer to the question?
I think that absolutely is an answer.
More of a vision. There is one thing. There is one thing that there is a bit more things, like I've seen experiments from Zynga and so on, but CCP.
New with IRL CCP.
Was it the future of games yesterday? They're going to have their second playtests on the 6th of December.
Okay. CCP.
Yeah, CCP.
For their blockchain game?
Yeah.
So it's public now. I didn't know if there are any details about their blockchain game yet.
It is Project Awakening. Project Awakening is getting its second playtest on December 6th. I think it's, from what I've witnessed in this industry, by far the endeavor with the highest potential of proving Web3 or Web 2.5 or anything surrounding this. If there's any team that has imagined running EVE Online for 20 years as the most sustainable, stable economy we've witnessed, as close as it gets to real world economy, the knowledge that's been embedded in that team, the way they've operated it, my bet's on them.
That makes a lot of sense to me, and I completely concur. We just had their game economist on the Game Economist podcast. I mean, he was in many ways the OG game economist, the first one to exist. Someone who got his PhD at the University of Ryland, lives in Iceland, all of those wonderful things. The question that always gets asked is, you've been running EVE for a really long time. It's been successful. You've managed an open marketplace. You've managed floating prices. It's been tricky, but again, to your point, they have the culture and they have the tribal knowledge to be able to execute against that. But after you work through all of that, what's the whole point of Web3 in a game like EVE? What does it actually end up doing? Because most of the EVE economy, the way it's driven, is by destructibility, which kind of defeats the whole purpose of NFTs, which have been about object permanence.
Triggered. No, it does not. Thank you, Philip, for that. That's, I think, why did Web3 fail? We've already kind of touched upon it, and everybody, easy to criticize in hindsight. But there is one thing, the economic phenomenon of failure was beyond except Ponzinomics, or kind of linked to Ponzinomics, was that inflation. Most of these assets accumulated to the point where their value, what value? To the point where not only were they not utility tokens and they were arguably, what am I going to do with this? But there were so many of them, they accumulated so much that they inflated, they crashed and burned and collapsed the whole thing. Any given Sunday, this happened. And I think one of the easiest ways of preventing this for anybody looking to give real world assets, NFTs, whatever tokens in the future, is to comfortably burn them, destroy them, exactly like EVE Online, exactly like that $300,000 battle or that Titan or that all of that hard work, unapologetically burn them. Don't put them in a basket. Don't downgrade them. Don't take them out of the system. Just make them go up in flames. For that is necessary for a healthy economy. I think that's one of the biggest lessons from there for Web3.
So then what does Web3 do that Eve wasn't already doing for it? Is it just a question of having more stakes in the game? That something can have a price in ETH and eventually, you know, a real price in USD that I can cash out of the system?
You mean
what does the blockchain bring to ETH that it didn't already have?
Right. Hilmar was just talking about this the other day.
Because I know, I mean, the answer is A16Z rolled up with a giant check and they're like, well, we're going to, when I look at the size of the check, we're certainly going to figure out the answer to that question. But usually it works backwards from the check.
And you know what? Innovation sometimes works like that.
That's, I completely agree. That can be appropriate. Yeah. I'm not throwing shade, but did they have an answer?
I'm not speaking on their behalf. I'm just telling you what I've heard Hilmar say literally yesterday. And that is Eve being as close to real world economy as it gets. And he was making these parentheses with the economy of Iceland and the fact that it's ISK and it's as close as it gets. And I think, I don't know, these are not the words. I think the team wants to try it. I think it feels natural for them. I think the vision of, can we manifest this? Can we actually pull it off? Are we the ones to pull off a real world economy, open economy, Web3 economy? That's a challenge I would take. I think they're in the right shoes to take it, and I wish them the best of luck.
Well, that makes two of us.
The games industry is experiencing unprecedented growth, with global revenues projected to reach a staggering $268 billion by 2025. But with more players than ever connecting across platforms and devices, how can your game stand out against the competition? AppsFlyer has created AppsFlyer for Games to help you unlock your players' true LTV by providing a wealth of game measurement solutions, unique industry insights, and proven best practices. Our dedicated hub is packed with innovative products, industry partnerships, and unrivaled expertise to ensure your game brand adapts and thrives. We understand that every game is unique, and AppsFlyer's data-driven insights allow us to cater to your specific needs. We know that in today's evolving landscape, staying ahead of the curve is crucial. Trust in AppsFlyer for Games to guide you through this exciting journey. We have the tools, the knowledge, and the passion to help you succeed in this ever-expanding landscape. Together, we'll conquer new worlds, both real and fantasy, break records, and create gaming experiences that leave a lasting impact. Get in touch with AppsFlyer for Games today and unleash your game's true potential. AppsFlyer for Games, supercharging the gaming landscape. This episode is brought to you by Data AI. Yes, they were called App Annie back in the day, but let's not talk about that. Let's talk about how Data AI is the first company to combine consumer and market data with the power of artificial intelligence. And Data AI does this to unlock unique consumer and market insight to accelerate competitive advantages across all digital channels worldwide. What we here at Deconstructor of Fun really like is Data AI's Game IQ tool. It's this fantastic market and competitive intelligence tool for mobile gaming that allows publishers to really get to the feature level of a game without doing the full-on deconstructing first. Using this tool, your team can quickly tie features to performance KPIs, which will help you make difficult roadmap decisions. It's also a great tool to identify hidden growth opportunities as you can analyze games on a scale. As you well know, there are hundreds of thousands of gaming apps in the App Store and thousands of new mobile games released each month. And while we don't want you to stop reading and listening to Deconstructor Fun, the fact is we can't cover it all. With Data AI, and especially their Game IQ tool, you'll be able to efficiently determine what features provide a lift, make roadmap decisions based on accurately modeled expected outcomes, discover how competitors lifted performance through feature releases, benchmark performance against your competitors, focus with confidence on the highest potential genre for a new game release. We here at Deconstructor Fun are huge fans of Data AI, so what are you waiting for? Go to Data AI and try the service for free.
So you've been building this product for what, 5 years now?
Yep.
So it's been a really long time that this has been in the market. What have you changed over those 5 years?
Within the product itself, within the market?
Within the product.
Machination's been around for 10 years or more since yours first put it out as a flash prototype along with his PhD called Engineering Emergence. Within the PhD and also within a book that he co-authored with Ernest Adams, Advanced Game Mechanics, which I still believe is the Bible of game design. Everybody should pick it up.
We'll have a link to it in the show notes as well.
It's out of print, so we can only get the PDF. I have a hard copy. I have a hard cover.
I'll see what I can dig up on the internet.
That is the ultimate NFT. that is ranging for 4 figures now. That history gone. We, together with Joris, we set out to turn it into a proper platform product, you know, take it next level 5 years ago. First step was simply porting it from Flash to JavaScript, simply. And there's air quotes in the simply. We started off with a Draw.io library, MXGraph, basic things. And the GUI, the UI, was under some sort of hybrid Draw.io library prefabs. Think of the tool, the product, which is a surface. What you see is what you get kind of thing, even though there's Monte Carlo in the background and stuff. It's visual all the time. And there's the dive part, and then there's all the panels surrounding it. So we'll refer to it as diagram and then UI. And in between them is UX. The diagram stayed a long, long time, pretty much the same thing as 10 years ago. And it still is at that stage. And we can talk about how I want to advance it, how we want to change it, if anybody cares. But until then, what do we change? We changed the UI. That was the fundamental part that changed. And we adopted, I think it was Google's Metal, is it called? The design framework. We've changed. I can keep talking about the UI where we did a major facelift, and that helped a lot with the user experience. And we went in a mirror direction. That was about 3 years ago. I guess little panels is not that interesting. What's interesting is charts, which is the science part. We extracted the charts that would previously be embedded into a diagram into sort of what's now becoming a statistical sort of panel. It's the charts show time series, so the evolution of these parameters. Now they show histograms. They show indicators. So we've added, I'd say, scientific analysis on top of these simulations. That was one of the main things we focused on. We've changed the logic of the framework. So Machinations fundamentally is a language. It's 9 symbols, visual, like Lego pieces. One of the major things we changed from Machinations in the old days to Machinations, whatever, when we launched it, I.O., let's call it I.O., that was the leap, was the way resources transfer over time was a time step. Think of it like a tick. You know how Counter-Strike 2 changed that tick, and it changed the game a bit. That tick, previously, the length of the connections would dictate how long the time it takes for a resource to get from A to B. And okay. We changed that to be only visual representation. So regardless of the length of a connection, all the resources are going to travel from their source to their destination in one tick.
What are people clamoring for, your customers? What's the next thing that they
want?
So, yeah, how do they feel like they want X, Y, or Z in the tool?
A long, long roadmap. Actually, a long, long icebox. The roadmap is pretty tight. The most exciting thing that's coming up within weeks is coming out this year. It's only to a private handful of studios in early beta, but it's a balancer. See, the vision has always been, one of my game designer, prior to starting Machinations, we were looking in the Flash tool. And he said, oh, Mihai, I get it, but if you can solve balancing, then that's the next big thing since sliced bread. And we're finally days, weeks away from solving that. What do I mean by it? The balancer, and it's an AI balancer, and it's probably the most AI you'll see as opposed to in the whole buzz of AI, this is 95 percentile AI.
Hold it's on, not just wanna, the, we have to pause the interview and shoo away the VCs who just heard the word AI here.
That's what it does. The balancer, you get these diagrams, you do a forecast, you look where the outcome is. You're like, you know what? 10 minutes of gameplay is too much. Or actually getting to level 9 in 10 minutes feels like too little. Let's change XP drops so that they get to level 10 in 11 minutes, whatever. All of these what-if scenarios currently you do manually in Machinations. So you change a parameter, you do a prediction. You change a parameter, you do a prediction. You do that until you hit the right value. And it's ridiculously less time than doing it live as you would typically do it. Finally, right now, you're able to tell the machine, I want my players to die only 3 times in the first 10 minutes. I want my players to reach level 11 on average in 15 minutes, whatever all of these scenarios. And then the machine does that thing that I mentioned, which is heat up servers, come back with a proper result. And it's an interval saying, well, actually, their starting HP points should be between 120 and 135. And you'll find the right answer. So target and influencers.
So if we think about balance, it seems to suggest that there is an optimal solution to balance, but it's optimal in what sense? So if we think about League of Legends, how could I use an AI balancer to tell me what the right values for League of Legends are? How do we know what the right balance is for League of Legends? Because I hear game designers talk a lot about this, which is balance. Yeah. And I never really know what they're optimizing towards. And the best definition I've heard is, well, we want equal pick rates. But then you start to press designers a little bit more on equal pick rates. And it's, well, maybe that's not the case. Maybe I want each character to have some sort of purpose. Maybe the healer doesn't need to have an equal pick rate. with the DPS. And when I hear, hey, we're going to use AI to balance, it's, I guess I would ask, towards what end? How do you know that whatever balance this is the optimal solution? Because to me as an economist, my answer to the optimal balance is the one that maximizes net present lifetime value, which is a lame answer. But to me, that's more of a crystal clear direction than, you know, I think, hey, something equal balance.
You're right. Financial game designers, which mostly sit in free to play, that's the bottom line. And that's what businesses care about. Now we get the aesthetic game designers. They're the ones that care about game play, game feel. You've picked the bane of my existence, League of Legends. I play ARAM. I don't play ranked. I don't pick. I get dropped carrot. In ARAM, you don't get to pick.
What's ARAM?
All random, all mid.
Okay. It's for me. Like,
yeah.
Okay. Sorry, I'm a Dota guy. So.
Oh, you should have said so in the beginning.
Well, I want the interview to go smoothly, okay?
Let me see where in League of Legends would I sit with a zoom in? Would it be the PvP combat when it comes because you've given me a support versus a tank? Would I want to model that and see what are the odds that one defeats the other versus zooming all the way out and saying, looking at a level where it's 5 versus 5 and how many matches are won across a season? I guess both questions are legit. To see balancing on an individual PvP and to see balancing on 5v5 with a roster of champions. That would be a lot of diagramming work. If you know anyone to try it in PvP, in a character versus character, I'm building the diagram in my mind and it's like a lot, right? Like it's
else points. The suggestion is that this AI feature is going to tell me something.
Right.
I just don't know what it's going to tell me. Towards what end is it going to give me an answer?
It's not about telling, it's about doing. Name a support in League of Legends, actually one which I feel like Sona, and it's versus a tank. Let's pick Garen. So Sona versus Garen. Both of them have health points. Sona has mana, Garen has no mana. We're both at starting level. Let's make this simple, we have no items. And what's the cadence of basic attacks and spell points and refresh time for spells? I'm trying to keep it simple for the sake of this conversation. Both characters have their stats and they have their cadence for attacks. Obviously, their life replenishes, especially Garen's. Now we're going to simulate some sort of basic player interaction where we expect them to attack continuously as soon as a spell refreshes or as soon as whatever their DPS odds are. This thing, you hit play, you see that Sona loses 1 out of 4 matches, but then you hit Monte Carlo and you see actually, well, Sona is going to lose only 0.3 out of 4 matches. Let's pick like a 20. So one gameplay, you would get this 25% effect roll, 1 out of 4. But when in Monte Carlo, you would get this 27.5. And these are the insights. This is what the tool tells you right now. What the balancer will be able to do is you're going to tell it, I want to make Sona OP. I want Sona to get close to 33.5. I want Sona to get to 33% of wins. And I think it feels right that I change. It would feel bulky if I change Sona's starting age points. Let's just leave it at is. How about, is there a knob, a limitation on mana refresh? Let's play with that. So what's the mana refresh rate? What's the minimum I need to bump the mana refresh rate so that Sona can do more spells over interval of time? So she gets to 33% wins. That's it. Machine, tell me. The machine comes back and says, well, actually, if the mana refresh rate is like 10 per second, you're going to be fine between 12 to 13. And then Riot Games chooses that, puts that in a patch, and a million people yell at them. There, problem solved.
What type of customers have you had in terms of game genre? Who's really gravitated toward this? Has it been Social Casino, Match 3, Squad RPG?
All of them. I kid you not, we have a study on 20,000 individuals. And if you look at that pie chart of genres, it's as segmented as, you know, the tiles on the building I'm looking at. It's like a wheel spike, like the spikes on a bike wheel across the full spectrum. The most common within that, and by most common, I mean none of them has double digit, but let's say it gets up to 5% or something, is whatever RPG's type of experience. It works beautifully because there's a lot of math that progresses over time.
Mm-hmm.
For casual, honestly, Machinations used to be an overkill.
Okay.
Now it's getting interesting because it's hyper-casual. You need some progression on that. You mentioned Social Casino. Yes, because Social Casino goes beyond just a random number generator, like an RNG, like pull a lever, drop something. Again, their servers are starting to see progression on them. Rooms, player behavior, all of that. And then the list goes on and on. Idle, Arcade, puzzles. Everything has a meta loop. Everything has a progression, don't they? So all of these digits evolving over time need to be balanced.
Do they need different features, or is the tool flexible enough where, hey, it's a general purpose programming language, plug and play?
Everybody wants something out of this tool. I want something. I mean, my team wants something. The CTO wants something. The product owner, the architect, sales, growth. And I'm just, these are just internal functions. Designers want something. Producers want something. Game economies. Everybody, you look at us and it's impossible not to come up with something I want. What people mostly want varies with the stage that they're at in their journey. If they've been using this for years, they want hyper-advanced tools. They start talking about referencing node IDs within functions, and they get into the spectrum of maybe scripting. They start talking about prefabs, components, zooming in and out. How do they master diagrams, which are 3,000 components? If they're in the beginning, they want to make them easier to grasp and understand, stuff like a debugger, a logger, basic things we didn't put in the tool in the beginning, right? Now we're circling back to that and looking at how do we actually foster visualization and communication. For communication within teams is one of the most important or sudden values you get when you open up this tool on your big screen. Somebody walks behind your shoulder, or you show it on Zoom, as it is these days. And they're like, what's that? What the hell is that? Tell me about it. Because they see the moving resources and the moving dots and the triangles and the circles.
It's all the animations. Always the animations. It's always a little coin animation moving along the line.
The good thing is they're actually real. They're not just smoke and mirrors. And so if it's in the beginning with that part of visualization and communication, it's how do I make these schematics even easier to read? And that's, you can think of basic things, dropping in images, replacing a node with an icon, replacing the token of a resource with a game icon, making it all more helpful. All the way to, if you've been doing this for quite some time, you probably want to tinker with advanced things within custom variables. If you're to ask everyone, it's probably dark mode.
The simple things in life.
Yeah, the quality of life things. And we're going to get dark mode just when the time is right.
All right, let's see what we got here. So who's been using this tool? Has it been exclusively game designers? Is it product managers? Is it data scientists?
It's a Figma model. A paradigm. It's a Figma paradigm. You get the editors. Those are definitely game designers. And if they sub-branch, game economy designers, system designer, whatever you call them. Who's been benefiting from the diagram is all the other roles you mentioned. I guess the main one is developers, looking in that diagram for source of truth and parameters, exporting it to a Google Sheet. We finally managed to put at least, I don't want to be condescending, but to some extent we put spreadsheets in their place, which is the only thing they should be used for. And that's data being inputted or extracted from a system, a data entry form. So they export a sheet, or they can do API integration, but most people just prefer a Google Sheet, honestly. Analysts, yes. What type of events are the most important ones? What type of event hooks I should put in the game? Because those are the KPIs. Producers, they just typically like to see a chart. We're actually going to come up with a feature within, a month or two, which is going to cover the whole diagram. Then the diagram becomes the engine, and you're going to get a nice cockpit hook. And a few parameters you can play with, which is, could be causing opening the gates of hell if you give a producer full access or even limited access to your design parameters.
Giving SQL database access to producers was probably one of my biggest mistakes as an analyst. Clogging up Snowflake, clogging up Hive.
Studio politics are going to get interesting. The purpose is maybe that, maybe not. It's like to make quick what-if scenarios, but again, to visualize and communicate. Oh, so these are the levers that matter for the progression of my players. How does it look like? What's the histogram? And that's not just for producers. It's for anyone that didn't actually build a diagram. It's, you get that effect over above a few hundred nodes where you have to take time to hand off what's in it, just like code, even though it's visual code.
So Unity, is a game engine that a lot of people love to hate and hate to love.
Mm-hmm.
They've been playing with some simulation tools. Do you have any concern that a game engine in which I've already built the logic of the game and I don't need to rebuild the logic and machinations is in some ways going to eat your lunch? Can I just run the simulation with the game that it's already built in Unity?
If you make your own bot, yes. I also have, I've loved Unity since there were a few hundred people. I know the founders. I have a love relationship with that company, and the whole pricing thing didn't make me hate it at all, like it did with polarizing the entire industry. The short answer would be yes. I guess if Unity would come up with a feature, Unreal, any game engine would embed this within their own engines, that would be an experience in itself. That would be a product in itself, but it would be a product. It's not a feature. Machinations is a product, not a feature. This is not one of those things you can simply sprinkle on top of something. The abstraction layer of the language in itself, that is something that so far in this entire industry, it's only yours that's put this together. It's been spreading on its own organically within academia for the past decade to the point where it's taught in 130 universities from MIT to Osaka. It's got 60,000 people purely organic. It's the only UML that I'm aware of that has grown and is growing on its own, and that's the language. Because you first have to teach people a language. It's not as easy as just sprinkle some simulation on top of some prefabs in Unity. If any game engine can pull that off, kudos. I hope they will be the Pepsi to our cola.
I wanted to talk to you about Heroic Labs. Building a successful game is hard enough without worrying about building your own game tech as well. Heroic Labs provides a comprehensive game stack to help you get your game into market faster and scale beyond the competition. With their Unity Game Framework Hero, you can cut development and prototyping time in half and quickly add social, economy, and reward systems to grow your game. Satori, the LiveOps platform built specifically for the games industry, lets you run live events, A/B tests, deliver dynamic content to players, and always keep your game growing. Nakama, the industry's leading open source game server, lets you develop locally, providing all social and competitive features for your game, and then seamlessly transition to their Heroic Cloud hosted service and easily scale to meet the largest of audience demands. Find out how to get started at heroiclabs.com. Hey game devs, are you tired of dealing with complicated payment processes all over the world? Well, Exola's got your back with Exola PayStation. It has a simple, user-friendly interface that makes it easy for players to pay for your games and in-game content however they want. And because the Exola PayStation user interface is adaptive and accessible on smartphones, tablets, and PCs, your players will have a seamless experience no matter their preferred device. Players can save their favorite payment methods for future purchases, and on mobile, even charge purchases directly to their phone carrier bill. On the back end, you can customize your checkout with game-specific integration options like sidebars and iframes, as well as change colors, fonts, and images to make PayStation look and feel like a natural part of your game. Ready to see Exola's PayStation in action? Visit exola.pro/payments-dof or visit the link in this podcast description.
So one of the things we've been talking about is game economies, and there are just so many different pieces to game economies. There's so many levers to pull. There's so many things a player can do. Has the complexity of game economies grown over time?
Yes, it has. And this is me talking now, just observing anecdotally, empirically. I don't know if we could extract this out of machinations, if we could run some sort of analysis of number of components per pool. No, this is just me talking now. That, yeah, I think just as a player, it's too much. They're getting so complex. You mentioned League of Legends. Look at all the side events, side quests, side things. Do this to do that, get this to do. Look at mobile games, look at any, even console is kind of slowly heading in that direction. Those kind of console still keeps it a bit old school. I appreciate that. I appreciate just a good narrative gameplay. I think it's too much, but that's just me as an individual talking about the gameplay systems I'm interacting with.
Do you think it's that game economies are becoming more complex, or are the questions we're asking more detailed and more intricate?
I'll flip the question and I say, I think the audience are becoming more sophisticated. You know, when I said I like to play console games, I instantly felt old. Like narrative, because there's a trick you need to know about me. I can't do shooters on a console. I mean, I put myself in story mode. I have a good time. I still get scared by The Last of Us kind of thing. Kids, like a Gen Z, you know, they'll rock you at PlayStation in the words of most deaf. And they've become more sophisticated with understanding. So they're free to play native. They understand microtransactions to come naturally for them. There was someone saying yesterday at the Future of Games event, something to the effect of, you know, Gen Z can't understand there was a time we used to pay money for games up front. Mm-hmm. Just as they can't understand why you need to shut down a PC with a button. So if it's native for them, if they interact with these microtransactions, mechanics, progression, pop-ups, gachas, all of them have come there since they're probably like, what's an acceptable age that you put a game within a kid's? I guess Copa can talk about that. You get the 4+ category on the App Store, right? And if they've been exposed to that, since they were kids, of course you need to feed them something which keeps them engaged longer. So I guess it's designers trying to cope with the audience instead of the audience that needs to be educated.
So one of the things we've been talking a lot about is tools. You've been talking about how the program has expanded to include more of statistical analysis. Is there just a huge skill gap for designers in game economies, understanding the statistical analysis, understanding the programming? Is this the gap that Machinations is filling?
Wow, nice one. I'm obviously biased, and I wish for every single designer on this planet to pick up this tool sooner than later. It only takes 4.2 hours to learn. Ta-ding! I think it's inevitable that we start using scientific tools in our craft. This market started, look at how many decades, and I've been in it since pretty much the days of the iPhone, went on this journey that what did the iPhone do? What did these platforms do? What did Unity do? What did everyone democratized? And they opened up. Everybody started making hundreds of these games each day. So many, so much competition, so much to chew from. So easy to put them out. Explosion, this phenomenon brought about with it some smash hits, some colossal hits. And there was a time when it was relatively easy. And I can't put big enough air quotes on what easy means. It was never easy. This is one of the toughest things you can do in software development. Building a good game with the right distribution, the right environment, the right time, and the right moment. We all know this, preaching to the choir. However, it has, look at it out there. I mean, we're in Helsinki and it's snowing and it's winter, but look at this industry this year. Now look at the trends we've been seeing, what's happened. Yeah, you know, the buzzwords, the ATT, the live ops, the whole trends that everybody's talking about. I'm seeing consolidation. I'm seeing it getting harder. I think there has been, we talk a lot about AI and ATT and live ops. We haven't spoken about Discover in a while. What happened with that? Does anybody remember the days when the app stores would dictate downloads and you could influence them? You can make a rise to the top campaign. It's gone, right? Like the app stores have become so walled. I'm trying to say it's tougher. It's just going to get tougher to put out a successful title and successfully operate it. So we have to get better, even though we're artists, and this is an art. I think it needs to move into the sphere of stage one being some sort of alchemy, where it's art with a bit of science. Let's get to fully grasp what analytics is, what proper math, I have to say Machinations, like I'm so biased, but proper tools which give our creativity a fundamental reasoning, rationale, solid bedrock, instead of it just feels right.
Do you think it's easier to teach data scientists design than to teach data science to designers?
Biased answer, I think it's easier to teach game designers data science, because I had to go that path.
Interesting. So you think it's easier to teach designers? So we think about like the data science stack. On one hand, you need to know SQL. That seems to be an important part of being a data scientist. That to me is like entry level stuff. You need to understand statistical analysis. And then generally you need to understand some sort of scripting language like an R, a Python, a JavaScript, a Java.
Oh, wait, hold on, Philip. No, I meant like use an analytics dashboard.
So I guess like this is kind of the challenge I see. Like we're starting to ask more intricate questions about game economies.
Yeah.
We want to start to know more about, hey, if I do X, where am I going to be on day 7?
Yeah.
Or maybe on day 8? I mean, especially with a game like Monopoly Go, there's a lot of randomness. There is a lot of random number generators.
Yep.
And I'm struggling to understand why game designers are the best people to answer those questions. Why aren't more data scientists becoming game designers? I mean, isn't that a better career path? And I see very little crossover between those two. And I can count on one hand the number of game designers I've met who understand what Monte Carlo is, and I don't mean this in a bad way, or who can program in SQL. And again, I think game designers have a multitude of things that they bring to the table. But when it comes to the technical skills, it just isn't there.
Wow. If this were a video recorded podcast, I'd be glancing long into the distance thinking of an answer. I think the traditional and how I recall it and we've all perceived it, designers were responsible of creating and the creativity and the create, so the source of things. And data scientists about analysis, so the other end of the spectrum after the creation had been deployed and it's been tracked. And I think it's that dynamic of in and out which caused me to say that I think the natural evolution is from creation to analysis rather than from analysis to creation. I don't This is not career advice of anything. I honestly don't know the answer. I think, what is a game designer? Fundamental tough question, because I thought about this on the way. And I've been thinking, how did I, this very morning, I thought, how did I pick up game design? I didn't go to school. I didn't. There's a couple of books I read, one of them being Advanced Game Mechanics. Get it on Amazon. And I've picked up game design by doing what the title of this very recording, sorry, what the tagline is, the deconstructor of fun. If you look at my photo album from a decade ago, there's walls and scrolls and endless pages of screenshots of every single title that was there on the App Store. I opened it up, I took screenshots, I would play it, I would analyze it to the point of getting bored or what, like just doing this every single day, hundreds, thousands of these titles installed and chewed up and analyzed and deconstructed to understand what goes on. I think there's no better practice to learn game design than that. Have these built-in glasses by default, don't they? They need to be able to understand and deconstruct system and understand what it is. The switch that it takes from being analytical to being creative, yeah, very valid. They could do that. They wake up one morning and say, hey, what, you know, I get it. I get why all of these rule sets have been put into place. I get why the math has been laid out like this. I'm going to try my own vision. Good luck. GG. Good luck. Have fun.
Do you think data scientists should be more involved in game economy design, either directly or as an assistant to game economy design?
I think they should be on the table. I think they should be at the table every time. Our idealistic table for a design session is comprised of a game designer, developer, analyst, artist, producer, our. Maybe it's a simplistic one. I guess there's multiple roles that you can feed in there, right? Like a lot more. Yeah, I think as with any product, not just within games. Analysts need to be there with most of the decisions so they can provide that input of, you know, last time we did that, John, let me just tell you about that experiment. Let me pull up this mix panel or whatever dashboard and show you what we've actually achieved or didn't achieve.
Where can we find more of you? How can we reach out? Someone wants to sign up for Machinations. How do they do it?
Free one click of a button in the browser, Google login, a few seconds, machinations.io. Reach out to me on LinkedIn anytime. I'm lurking on Twitter, but LinkedIn, anytime.
My guest today has been Mihai.
Thanks, Philip.
You did it. You made it to the end of the episode. As a fan of the show, it would help us out if you subscribe and leave us a review on the podcast service of your choice. More importantly, are you a member of the Deconstructor of Fun Slack group? If you have 5 years or more of games industry experience, go to deconstructorofun.com/slack and apply to join. Join the games industry's best professional community, filled with peers always willing to lend a hand. Or subscribe to our newsletter to get all the latest insights from the Deconstructor of Fun content creators. Thanks for listening.